From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When the Secretary of State Colin Powell made the case for going to war with Iraq before the UN Security Council in February of 2003, Lawrence Wilkerson was there. Wilkerson was Powell's chief of staff, so he played an important role in drafting that speech. And when it was over, Wilkerson is reported to have left the UN building, where he returned to his hotel room and fell into a deep sleep. He said that when he woke up, he was depressed. And when he looks back on that speech and the case they were making, he said it was the lowest moment of his life. But Wilkerson says now he's seeing the same kind of case being made by the Trump administration, this time with Iran. And this time, he's speaking up. Wilkerson is in Utah this week, joining us to explain what it means to build a campaign to make a case for war. Join us after the news.
Hey, I'm Michael Toomey from KUER's membership team. Thank you to all of our loyal listeners, sustainers, and donors who contributed to our spring fund drive. We came up just a bit short of our goal, but don't worry, there is still time to give. Make your gift today to help us continue to bring you the shows you love and the local news you count on. Visit us online at KUER.org to donate.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In 2005, Lawrence Wilkerson gave a speech at the New America Foundation, which got a lot of attention. He had been the chief of staff for Colin Powell, the Secretary of State, and he played a role in preparing Powell's now notorious speech before the UN Security Council, making the Bush administration's case for going to war with Iraq. Wilkerson had private reservations and regrets at the time, but he waited a few years to speak out publicly. In the speech, he called President Bush and his foreign policy team amateurish, said that Vice President Dick Cheney and Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld had acted as a cabal to pressure the president to go forward with the war. He even criticized Powell, said he had been too worried about damage control. And after Wilkerson's speech, the New York Times said it represented the final turn in his transition from Republican insider to apostate. Lawrence Wilkerson has remained outspoken about that war and what he sees as another one coming, this time with the United States and Iran. In a recent op-ed in the New York Times, Wilkerson says the Trump administration is making the case for war. He called it a campaign built on politicization of intelligence and short-sighted policy decisions. Colonel Wilkerson is in Utah today here with the Hinckley Institute of Politics. He's also a guest of the Semnani Family Foundation, and he's joining us today to talk about the lessons he's learned in the past and what he's seeing now. Lawrence Wilkerson is a retired colonel, served in the U.S. Army for 31 years. He's a distinguished visiting professor of government and policy at the College of William and Mary. Colonel Wilkerson, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
It's good to be back in Utah.
What do you make of, I kind of wanted to highlight that moment in the New York Times piece from several years ago now, calling you, making that turn from insider to apostate. Did it seem like that at the time?
It did to a certain extent, but more forbidding for me, if you will, was the fact I was a military professional, as you said, for 31 years, and military professionals in my protocol don't speak out. They go quietly into that dark night. But it was really the torture issue that got me. When Powell put me to looking into the torture issue, and I discovered that torture occurred at the highest levels, as to say policy-wise, the president approved it, that got me. I had to speak out.
That was the moment that—
That was the thing that did it. That was the straw that broke the camel's back.
I wanted to ask you about that, actually, because it seems like this is one of the things that you have you've talked about. There's this course that you've taught, I'm not sure if you still are, described as fateful decision-making.
Yes, very much so. And it's at the heart of all my national security courses.
Is that right? So I wanted to ask about that because one of the things you've described it this way. It's the idea of when old men send young men to die, young men and women, of course, to die for state purposes.
Exactly.
Would you talk a little bit about that? Because this seems to get at what was gnawing at you then in terms of the war in Iraq.
We study every president from Harry Truman to the present president with a great deal of detail, as you might imagine, with regard to Harry and Dwight and those early presidents, because the archives are there.
Yeah.
my students do case studies on these fateful decisions, whether it's a covert operation like the overthrow of Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran in 53, or whether it's an open war like the Vietnam War, the war I fought in. And as we do this, we begin to understand where the United States is going with regard to the war power, especially since the creation of the all-volunteer force, which we might call the all-recruited force or even the Foreign Legion. We have put that force in the field to kill people for state purposes under some very specious circumstances. Look at what we are, where we are now. We've been at war for 17 straight years with no end in sight. This is becoming an empire that has one instrument of national power, and that's the Pentagon.
I want to read something that you've said. You quoted as saying that you've stood on the hot parade ground as a pilot. You've cursed generals and understood, this is how you put it, the bestiality that comes over men when they're asked to use force for the state. Would you talk a little bit about that? Because there's a moment that I'm not sure if you're willing to talk about it right now, but there was a young girl killed in innocent, obviously, as civilian in Vietnam that seemed to have an influence on the way you're thinking about this.
Yes, it was clear to me that when you really don't have a strategy, when all you're saying is victory, that's got to be the end product, and all you're asking for is more men and more money, and there's no victory in sight, it becomes really questionable. Every time you pop a cap, every time you pull a trigger, every time you put your bayonet on your rifle, every time you do anything like that, it becomes very difficult to do, more and more complex to justify it if you're a thinking, sentient human being. So I wound up a couple of times, for example, when I was in a so-called free fire zone.
Yeah.
The colonel had declared it a free fire zone, which very simply meant you could kill anything that moved, from a Bengal tiger to a 13-year-old girl. I interposed myself between some people who were willing to follow those orders and me and my conscience that wasn't willing to follow those orders. So in a very real sense, in Vietnam, I began to see what war does to people, particularly war that has no real strategy and no real end in sight other than to perpetuate itself.
One of the things you've talked about is that and you've been somewhat critical of the way that the American public has looked at this. And I think what you've said, and help me if I get this wrong, is that we've come to a point as an American public where we're seeing the efforts by the executive branch to conduct war as just a sort of a given right, that they and we're seeing that as commonplace and not asking the same kinds of questions that we have in the past maybe or should be asking.
And part of that's we've got 99% of Americans have no skin in the game. Yeah. We don't have a draft. We have an all recruited force that we bribe to serve, and that's no pejorative. That's no criticism of their patriotism. Many of them are sterling patriots. And some of them are very worried and very concerned, too. That's why they come back with post-traumatic stress. But it is an all-recruited force. And I can statistically show you, how since 1973, when the Gates Commission ended the draft and created that force, we have been at war four or five times more frequently than we were with the conscript force that came out of World War II in Korea. So it's clear to me that the president feels that one of the powers he has that he can use at any time without any check or balance, really, is the military. And that's why you see every problem in the world a nail and the military the hammer to fix it.
I want to back up. I want to go back to February of 2003. This is when Colin Powell, you were his chief of staff at the time, made this case for military action at the UN Security Council. And I want you to, if you would, sort of go with me and let's talk about the preparation for that. Before we get to that, when Colin Powell knows he's going to have to make this case, the Bush administration wants him to go before the Security Council of the UN and make this case, and they give him a speech that you guys have to all rework and redraft and all that stuff. We'll get to that. But when you knew that was going to be the moment, the thing that was going to happen, what were you thinking then, 2003, February?
I had two very immediate thoughts. One was, you're doing it to me again, boss. I mean, he'd done this to me before, giving me an impossible mission at the last minute. We only had five, 6 days and nights.
Yeah.
And we were going to present the same way I'd like Stevenson did on the Cuban Missile Crisis. And so my second thought was, how come you, boss? Adlai Stevenson did it fine for a much more serious crisis in 1962. There were nuclear missiles in Cuba. How come you've got to do it? And he looked at me like, you asked that question, Larry. And I knew what he meant. I'm the most popular member of the administration. The American people trust me. The international community trusts me. I'm going to be the one to have to deliver it. So I said, Mr. Secretary, this is incredibly too short-fused. And so he said, I know. I've already asked Dr. Rice, the National Security Advisor, to get the president to postpone it a little bit. It's not any rush that we're in here. But the president had already had his team make a public announcement, and he was not willing to retract it. So then my feeling was, do I quit now?
Yeah.
Because I really thought this was it. This was just – let me back up a moment. In November of 2002, when we had gotten a 15-0 vote in the UN Security Council, 15-0 in favor of our resolution for looking hard at Iraq. Powell had walked into my – we had adjoining offices. He walked into my office, and he looked out at the Washington Monument, and he just mused. I didn't say a word. I didn't know what he was doing. He walked over, and he said, I wonder what will happen if we put 500,000 troops on the ground in Iraq and scour the country from one end to another and find nothing. And he turned around and walked back in his office. It was a rhetorical question. I dared not answer it.
Yeah.
But it started me to thinking. I'd already had a number of inspectors in my office at Richard Haass's. He knew these people.
We should say he was the Secretary of State, and you served under him at
that. Yeah, well, Richard was the policy planning director,
yeah, right.
Ambassador Haass. And he had a guy by the name of Neil Jock on his staff, whom I came to know fairly well. And Neil got these inspectors into my office. They'd been inspectors in Iraq. They knew what was going on in Iraq. And they'd given me some reason to doubt. They told me his chemical weapons might be in Sudan, being maintained there. They told me his biological weapons might be in Syria, being maintained there, because he was worried about sanctions and worried about another attack. So he was being circumspect, but none of them were very firm. Yeah. So here's the secretary telling me he's got doubts. And now, a month or so later, here we are going to present this case, and we called it Disarming Iraq, at the United Nations Security Council. So I've got grave concerns.
Now, when they gave it to you, as I understand it, it was a 48-page, single-spaced document.
Yes, prepared by John Hanna and Scooter Libby in the vice president's office, and it read like a legal brief. It was nonsense to take it into a supposed intelligence.
What did you describe it as? You said it was. It looked more like a badly written novel.
Badly written novel or a Chinese smorgasbord from which you could pick whatever you wanted to do. And frankly, the piece I got from the CIA on terrorism and Saddam Hussein's connections with al-Qaeda in particular was just as speculative and just pure circumstance. Powell called it this as we got into it. He called it Deuteronomy. And by that, he meant Ahab begat Mohammed begat. He said, this is crazy. This is absurd. And here's a good case of how we got tricked. Powell grabbed me by the stacking swivel, so to speak, and pushed me into a room. And the first words out of his mouth, he'd never acted that way towards me before. I knew he was frustrated. First words out of his mouth, "Do you think this room's safe?" I said, "Well, it is the National Intelligence Council and the CIA. I don't know." He said, "Well, there's nobody else in here. Sit down." I sat down. He was angry. He said, "This terrorism stuff in my presentation, connections with al-Qaeda, it's bull," he said something else.
Sure.
"Take it out." And I thought he thought I was going to object. I looked at him and I said, "Boss, it's gone. I don't like it either." So I went to Lynn Davidson, who was writing the thing, putting it together in the computer.
Yep.
I said, "Lynn, take this out." John McLaughlin, the deputy director of Central Intelligence, was standing there at the door. He disappeared. I should have picked up on that signal. Mm. We're back in the main conference room and we're rehearsing. Powell's stopped mid-rehearsal by Tenet walking back in the room, George Tenet, the director of Central Intelligence.
Yep.
And George puts a bombshell on the table. He says to Powell, "We have just learned from interrogations of a high-level al-Qaeda operative of al-Qaeda members in Iraq teaching the Iraqi Secret Service and military how to use chemical and biological weapons most effectively." Powell turned to me and said, "Put it back in."
Wow.
This was all from the torture in Egypt with no U.S. personnel present of Sheikh al-Libi. Within a week or two, the Sheikh recanted everything he'd said. The DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, put an immediate burn notice out on it saying don't pay any attention to this because it was gained under torture. No U.S. personnel were present when he was tortured. We never were told any of that. We didn't know his name. We didn't know the source. We just knew that the DCI, George Tenet, thought this was valid intelligence.
So Colin Powell, and then by extension the rest of you writing this speech, believed Tenet. That it had been a legitimate—
It had been a legitimate interrogation, and it had been a high-level al-Qaeda. Furthermore, Tenet constantly brought in France, Israel, Jordan, Germany, the BND in Germany, as if they were acquiescing in this intelligence picture. I later learned that what he was doing was quoting some friend of his in that intelligence service, that in no way did those intelligence services as a body agree with the picture we were presenting, but he presented it differently.
I've read it described this way, the speech, is that you believed that you had to protect Colin Powell's integrity against those within the administration who had been out to tarnish his reputation. Would you explain that? Because this seemed like another really strange dynamic going in this speech. You're trying to protect the integrity of your boss, trying to figure out how much of this intelligence is actually workable, is proper evidence to present before a world court, basically. There's a lot going on.
Yes, a lot. And the Deputy Secretary of State, who from time to time, Rich Armitage, would have me in his office or come down to my office, and he'd say, Chief, look here. And we'd look at something that John Bolton had done, for example, or whatever. And Rich began to refer to the vice president's office as the Gestapo and the Nazis. And I began to understand why he was doing that, because as you pointed out earlier, there was this group that was attempting to take the United States to war, come hell or high water. And they realized that they needed at that point to get the American people on board at least enough where they were supportive. They'd fail with the international community, except for Britain. And they politicized the intelligence to do that. They packed the intelligence. They cherry-picked the intelligence in order to do that.
Here's one thing you said. You said what we were all involved in. And then you said groupthink.
There was some groupthink. People, but like Tenet, for example, here's a perfect example of one of the expressions Tenet made at one point. He said, well, it doesn't really matter what the particulars are because we all know when we get there, meaning when the military forces get there, we'll find something. Hmm. Now, what a comment coming from the man, $100 billion intelligence apparatus. He's at the top of it. And he says, it doesn't matter about the particulars because we'll find them when we get there.
Okay, now, at what point in this process, so you're basically given by the White House 5 days. Now, this is
and
another,
nights. Don't forget the nights. We did not sleep. And remember, the shuttle went down on that Saturday. Wow. So that impacted us majorly. The White House took its tech data package back. In other words, I lost all of my audiovisual experts, and they are experts in the White House. CIA was incompetent in that regard. They couldn't put a package together to fool Walt Disney. So I had the White House team. Well, when the shuttle went down, I lost them. I had to call Dr. Rice and get them back. The president
thought but they wouldn't extend your time.
Well, it was announced, and the president wasn't going to back off on that announcement.
Yeah. So in that time, was there ever a point at which, I know you've written this letter, you had written this letter at some point in this, I'm not sure when it was, and you can tell me, basically it was a resignation letter.
Yes.
So at what point in the process when you're writing this speech or helping to draft this speech, put it all together, do you think, we can't do this, I can't be a part of this?
I don't think I ever came to that definitive and decisive a conclusion. I thought it a number of times,
yeah,
as much from the technical impossibility of what we were trying to do as from anything else. I mean, we were listening to Arabic, to Farsi intercepts from the NSA and trying to get multiple translators so we knew nobody would cherry pick that because I didn't understand Arabic or Farsi. So I'm listening to it and I'm listening to the translator and I have to trust the translator. So I said, okay, let's have a couple of translators and let's check and see independent of one another.
Wow.
And I'm listening to these other things. I'm looking at satellite photography down in the basement. I look at a satellite photograph of a UN inspection team moving into an ammunition supply point that we suspected of having chemical weapons. I'm looking at a photograph 3 days before. When the UN inspection team is pulling through the gates, the whole point has been changed. It's been cleaned. So your conclusion is that point had chemical weapons
there. Yeah.
What I think now is Saddam Hussein knew about our satellites. So do the North Koreans. They knew the capabilities of them. And so they spoof us sometimes. They fool us through their own satellites. And Saddam did not want Iran to know he didn't have any chemical biological weapons left.
I think this was an interesting element of this story. You and your colleagues watched a video of that Edley Stevenson presentation before the Security Council, as you mentioned, during the Cuban Missile Crisis. This was in 1962. What was that about? What were you trying to find?
It was mostly just to see the architecture, the way they did it, the format and so forth, but also to ask the team I'd assembled in my office at that point, some of them, not all of them, why do you think Powell's doing this and not John Negroponte, who was Ally Stevenson's equivalent then, U.S. ambassador to the United Nations?
But the answer is clear.
Everybody knew.
Because he's still popular.
Yeah. Powell's the only person that Americans, you know, he had poll ratings like Mother Teresa.
Yeah.
You know, he was in the low 70s, mid 70s, high 70s.
And George W. Bush had approval ratings, what?
They had gone down considerably. Remember, as he took that brush pile in New York, that debris pile in New York with that megaphone and said, and they'll hear from us?
Yeah.
It was about 90 in the polls. But they had gone down considerably after that.
So when he gave the speech, Colin Powell, you've described him as being incredibly nervous.
Powell's never nervous.
Oh, is that right?
One of his principles is never let him see you sweat.
I see.
And he was good at that. He wasn't nervous. I think what we both were was skeptical.
Huh.
And you can only maintain that skepticism if you're at that level of power in the U.S. government, as long as you feel like you've got a modicum of truth on your side. And so when you're listening to the man, George Tenet, you're listening to the director of Central Intelligence, you're listening to the vice president, ultimately. You're listening to all these people, and they're firing this stuff at you. And you're not an intelligence expert yourself. You're a user. You've been a user for a long time. But you're not an expert in the crafting of the intelligence. And the expert is sitting in front of you telling you it's a slam dunk, telling you the case is made. It's very difficult for you to challenge that without just being, even in your own mind, perhaps violative of the loyalty you owe to your president.
Yeah. And plus, you're a military man.
Yes. Yes, both of us were.
Hard to say no.
Yes. Look at what's happening right now with Jim Mattis, John Kelly, before with H.R. McMaster.
What do you think they're going through?
Well, one of the reasons I think it's so dangerous to have that many military people around the president is just what you described. There's too much loyalty there and too much military professionalism there, which likes this instrument called war.
So after the speech was over, I've read accounts of you basically going back to your hotel room and just crashing.
And slept for about 7 days and nights.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. So obviously
my speechwriter, Lynn Davidson, she was a pearl. But, I mean, she was almost a zombie. A lot of people aren't used to, like, military. I'm used to going on 3 hours of sleep a night as a military officer, but civilians aren't usually used to that.
You crashed, but at what point did it occur to you? Well, there's this story that I want to ask you about. Apparently, you had to commemorate the experience of writing this speech. You had these plaques made for people, but you didn't get one made for yourself.
No, and the secretary wondered. So he gave me a letter on secretary paper, you know, and I tore it up and threw it in the garbage can. I was so frustrated at that point. I was so angry at all that we had orchestrated. But I gave the letters and the plaques to the other people because they had done an unbelievable job. I never thought it was accomplishable. Scott Sforza from the White House tech team just did an incredible job. I never thought we would put on a presentation with the technical capability that he demonstrated. I mean, you get those NSA intercepts, you got the Arabic going up, you got the English translation and so forth. That was very hard to do. And so we got captured by that technical aspect of it too, trying to make it as believable as possible.
What impact did it have?
It didn't have much international impact.
No.
And it didn't have any impact in the UN, in the Security Council.
But you've said that wasn't the point.
That wasn't the point. The point was America.
Yeah.
And polls showed, especially his assertion that it was post 9/11, that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11 by his association with Al Qaeda, that was very powerful. And the poll showed the American people were a majority support for the invasion. And that's all the president and the vice president wanted.
So that was essentially the intent, you think, from Dick Cheney and Rumsfeld, and then by extension, of course, the president himself. The point wasn't to make the case to the international body.
We had Jack Straw in the United Kingdom. We did not have Dominique de Villepin in France. We didn't have Gerhard Schroeder in Germany. We knew we weren't going to get them.
Yeah.
No amount of talking would have got them. We were after the American people.
It's Lawrence Wilkerson, retired Army colonel, served as chief of staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson is our guest, probably best known for his role as Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell, and the part he played in preparing Powell's speech to the United Nations justifying the war in Iraq. It's a moment Wilkerson now regrets, and he's in Utah today, joining us to talk about what he sees as the parallels for that case for war in Iraq, and the new case, he says, that's being made for a war with Iran. He's going to be speaking, giving a lecture at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on the campus of the university. We'll give you the particulars about that a little bit later on the program. You can go to our website for that. So when you... At what point did you decide that you had to speak out, that you had to say something? I mentioned that speech that you gave to the New America Foundation. What was going on in your thinking? You're a military man. You usually keep your mouth shut.
True.
But you had to say something, I guess. What was going into your thinking about that?
I had been appointed by Powell as the State Department investigator, if you will, into Abu Ghraib and the atrocities that occurred there, the torture that occurred there. I worked with Admiral Church in the Pentagon, although he quickly abandoned me, and I quickly realized that the Pentagon was going to come up with a pro forma answer. Donald Rumsfeld gave it a few bad apples. My research for Powell showed me it wasn't a few bad apples. It was from the very highest level. It was the president and vice president of the United States. And
it was a visible audit trail.
Right.
Yep.
And there was a chapeau of legality created by John Yoo and Jay Bybee and others, David Addington, Cheney's lawyer, looking over that in the Office of Legal Counsel in the Department of Justice. So I knew there had been atrocities in the past, the Philippines, Vietnam, Korea, but never had there been a president and a Department of Justice who made the policy for the military and the CIA to carry out. This really disturbed me. By the time I had a dossier built up that really corroborated all this, it was time for us to leave the State Department in January 2005. So I sat on that, literally. And my conscience sat on that for months until I finally said, this is crazy. I saw the attempts to rehabilitate the Bush administration, saw Cheney giving his talks and so forth at the American Enterprise Institute. And so I said, I can't tolerate this anymore. I've got to come out and I've got to talk. And so in October of 2005, I went to the New America Foundation and spoke out.
The elements of that speech, I want to break down some of those because it seems like there are some of the lessons about the administration, some of the dynamics that were playing out then seem apt today. So I want to do that. But before, I wanted to ask you about something. Secretary Powell leaving the administration, right after the election, he gets this phone call from Andrew Card, chief of staff of the president, says the president wants to make a change. And I just wanted you to tell the story about that because I find it so interesting that Powell has this, I think he described it as strange. It seems like this weird meeting with the president that sort of to say goodbye. The president's not quite aware what's going on. And
wasn't even aware Powell was meeting him that day.
Yeah.
13 January 2005.
Will you talk about that? This was such an odd moment, I thought.
The entire process just reeked with either incompetence or intent, and you can take your pick.
Yep.
I had been called by Andy Card and the White House personnel office. He turned the call over to them, and they'd briefed me on, as they did all the chiefs of staff in the cabinet, on how the president wanted things to go with personnel. If you wanted to stay, let him know. If you wanted to leave, let him know. But everybody wouldn't leave at the same time. Typical thing.
Yeah.
And if you wanted to switch positions, let him know, and they would adjudicate it. Right in the middle, I briefed the secretary on that, and he's content. Okay. He thinks he's staying through the 21 January, as I recall, Iraqi elections. He wants to see what happens in Iraq with the elections. And so right after Veterans Day, the election's over, right after Veterans Day, there's this request for him to submit his resignation. He was furious. He was absolutely furious. He typed out his own resignation letter. And to get him even more furious, some little staffer in the White House sent it back because it had a typo. He disappeared. No one will talk about this. It hasn't been made public. He disappeared. It was so serious that the Deputy Secretary of State walked into my office and asked me if I thought we should cut a set of orders, because anytime the secretary was out of country or out of touch, we had to appoint Rich as the acting secretary or someone else in the chain of command. That's how serious it was. And then all of a sudden he showed up. But he was so frustrated and so angry at the way he was treated. And then, because of the tsunami in Indonesia and his going to Indonesia to be the U.S. rep there, and he was the only one who could, and all the ambassador corps in Washington was pleading with me to get him to go, he went. We had to postpone his out call on the president. They moved it to 13 January. I'm getting these calls from Andy Card's staff asking me to provide talking points. And I'm saying, you need talking points to talk with the first cabinet officer in the administration? Been here 4 years? Okay, Russia, Japan, China. And I was angry, too. But they finally set it for 13 January. Powell comes back and tells me after this outcall that they didn't even know he was coming, that the president was so angry he started screaming for Card from the Oval Office because the president was caught unawares that Powell was there. That said, Powell unloaded on the president. One of the things he told him was that he had the most dysfunctional decision-making process ever in the history of the United States. And the president's response was, well, you were there when Reagan had Schultz and Weinberger and all that mess. You, Mr. President, it's orders of magnitude worse in your administration. Then the president sat down and listened. And it's not beyond the ken that later when he fires Rumsfeld and puts Cheney in a closet. And, of course, Condi's now Secretary of State, much less a political threat to George W. Bush. We mustn't forget that. Karl Rove whispering in Bush's ear from time to time that the most likely threat in 2004 was from his own Secretary of State. Remember, he'd not run in 95.
That's right.
So Rove was right in that sense. But Powell had no intent on running for the White House. But that was another dynamic in there. And this outcall, I think, opened Bush's eyes to a certain extent. And we see, November 2006, he gets rid of Rumsfeld. He puts Cheney in a closet. By the time we get to the end of the second administration, it's not a bad administration. And Cheney is no longer to be heard.
It's interesting. One of the things that I've heard described about you is that you have two qualities that were really important to Colin Powell, but I'm guessing this is something that you do in the way you make assessments about things generally. First is that you can always find the big picture of whatever's going on. And second, that you, as this person put it, you always tore things apart, that you never take things at face value. And what you're doing, so the idea of breaking something down, and as you're looking back on what had happened, how we got to that point, going to war, what are you seeing as some of the elements? And let me just sort of cue you on one of them. One of the things you talked about was the problem of concentrating too much power in the hands of small groups of insiders, Cheney and Rumsfeld in this particular case. And you talked about making decisions that the bureaucracy ultimately didn't know were being made. Now, I think what's interesting about that to me is I'm wondering if you're seeing the same kind of thing going on right now in the Trump administration.
I certainly am. And I'm seeing it with as inexperienced a president, certainly, as was George W. Bush. And I'm seeing it with a team that, as my students would say, is inexplicable in the advice they're giving, and a president who is equally inexplicable and even perplexing in how he's going to react to that advice. One of my students, one of my brighter students, put it, he tweets. That's his policy pronouncements, is tweets. Does he even take a National Security Council meeting, or does he just go up in the second, third floor and make his decisions based on Fox News? These are very bright students making these comments because they followed this very closely. If you look at the Bush administration, you understand how dysfunctional it was, but had experts around, really talented. Remember, this was the super team. This was the dream team. Colin Powell, Dick Cheney. These were Donald Rumsfeld, former Secretary of Defense. Now we've got the nightmare team and the nightmare president. And my students, frankly, are profoundly concerned about their future and where this country's headed under this administration, particularly with regard to what they've been studying, which is the war instrument. And one of them put it this way, for example, will this president, in an attempt to save his presidency, go to war? And frankly, the other students couldn't answer that question. That's a sad commentary.
What do you think?
I think he would. And it frightens me.
It's interesting John Bolton has reemerged, this time as the National Security Advisor for Donald Trump. You gave testimony to the staff of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee about Bolton back in 2005. In there, you said that he had been a major cause of tension and resentment. So what do you make of the fact that he's now reemerged in the Trump administration?
I think it's dangerous. I think it's very dangerous, and principally because this is a very inexperienced president. One of my students actually said they claim that he's a great businessman, four bankruptcies and maybe a fifth one that the Russian oligarchs bailed him out of. How is this great business skill? They've got a point. So having John Bolton, who's not stupid, in there as the National Security Advisor means one of two things. It means that the president won't empower him, and that's the only way a National Security Advisor gains power, is the president empowering him, because he has nothing. Or the president gives him everything and says, go ahead and do whatever you need to do, John. I'm busy, or I'm tweeting, or whatever. And that's rather worrisome, because John will use Gina Haspel or whomever is at the CIA. I hope Gina's not confirmed. And he will use the other instruments of power that are available to him to do some bad things, in my view. Look back at Reagan. When Reagan took his eye off Bud McFarlane and Admiral Poindexter, the Iran-Contra scandal occurred, and we almost lost that president to impeachment. I mean, the articles were pretty strong. Reagan, the great communicator, went out and mostly apologized to the American people, and I think convinced them in an ambiguous way, which he intended, I'm sure.
He did.
That he really didn't know all about it.
Yeah.
And he might not have. I mean, we've studied Reagan to the nth degree, and there is reason to conclude that he wasn't as read in to what was going on as we might think.
How did he put it? I believed everything in my soul believed that this was the truth.
Right.
I'm not sure how
you get that
exactly.
way. In the ivory tower, right? You get that way because you only have access to the people to whom you have access, like John Bolton. You hear the world from these people. You get your view of the world from these people. So you better be very careful how you select these people.
Well, let's get to the case that the Trump administration is making, in your eyes, for a war in Iran. When we get back from a break, let's take a quick break and we'll come back in a moment. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson is with us, distinguished visiting professor of government and policy at the College of William Mary. A retired Army colonel, served as chief of staff to Colin Powell from 2002 to 2005. We'll take another quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. He's a distinguished visiting professor of government and policy at the College of William Mary, well known as being the former chief of staff to retired Secretary of State Colin Powell, helped to draft that case that was made by Secretary Powell before the UN Security Council in 2003. He's giving a lecture at the University of Utah. We'll give you the details about that a little bit later on the program. He's joining us to talk about some of the lessons he's learned along the way here. I wanted to ask you about the op-ed piece that you wrote recently. You said that the Trump administration is using much the same playbook in terms of a strategy for building the case. You said they've created a false impression that war is the only way to address some of these threats posed by Iran. Do you mean that literally, same kind of playbook, like you're seeing the same kinds of strategies employed?
I do with regard to the neoconservatives. I see the same sort of propaganda coming out. I see the same sort of false or partly false intelligence coming out from places like the Foundation for Democracy, funded by very wealthy Jewish Americans, by the way. What I see different this time that I didn't see so prominently the first time with Iraq is the state of Israel participating in this in a very forceful, in front of the foxhole way. Avigdor Lieberman, for example, the Russian emigre defense minister of Israel, was going to give a keynote speech at the Jerusalem Post conference in New York this month on the 29th of April. It was entitled The Coming War with Iran. So it's clear what the defense minister of Israel is thinking about. I find it curious that apparently, I've looked all over the web in the last 24 hours, they have changed that title and maybe even changed his role in the conference because clearly Israeli leadership thought that maybe was a little bit too far. But Israel was certainly incidental to the first war, but it wasn't incidental to the way it is today. The attack yesterday, for example, on Homs by Israeli fighter aircraft against Iranian drone manipulators on the ground killed seven Iranians, apparently. Mm-hmm. This is a terrific way to help the president get into this war if he wants to get into this war. And look at what we just did. We have not had a U.S. military base in Israel since 1948. We've never had one. We just put the stars and stripes over a small Air Force base in Israel, called it a U.S. Air Force base, and now we have bona fides on the ground in Israel if any Hezbollah missile attack occurs or whatever. We can go to the U.S. Congress and say, U.S. troops have been attacked. Look at what that does for Bibi Netanyahu in Israel if they really want to take Iran on. They know they can't do it by themselves, so they've got to have Big Brother help them.
I wanted to get you to respond to, I know you're familiar with the fact that you're being criticized for your position on Israel. You're even referencing you as one journalist called you a bigot, said you were anti-Semitic.
Anti-Semite.
And anti-Semite references to those two Jewish billionaires. You mentioned Sheldon Adelson, of course, one, and Paul Singer, the other. And this was something that New York Times decided to take out of your op-ed, that reference. And I wanted you to just respond to the criticism and what that
well, it was going, they wanted to put it online first, the online version, and then put it in the print version because apparently they got a lot of hits on the online version. So the staff of both people, Adelson and Singer, had called in. Adelson's staff had convinced the staff of the Times, known to be a bit biased towards Israel, just look back at the first war, that Adelson had backed away some 5 years ago. And so they took him out. Singer's staff was not convincing. Singer's staff couldn't convince them. But in order to put it in the print version, they printed a correction with regard to Adelson in the online version and went with the print version with it taken out. And I understood that because the editor said it wouldn't fit with that in there. So, but it's been dicey. Dick Cheney used to leak intelligence to two reporters at the New York Times. The Times would run with it, sometimes front page above the full right side. And then Dick Cheney would take it to the president and say, look, look, the New York Times says it. This is a technique, and Cheney mastered it, and I'm seeing some of that again.
I've heard you be critical of the American press.
Yes. Corporately owned and very much in line generally with their corporate interest.
But you did write an op-ed for the New York Times.
Yes, and they did print it, so yeah. I applaud them. Yeah. The gray lady came through.
But to the criticism, you called Israel an apartheid state.
West Bank. Quoting Gideon Levy from Haaretz.
But I just to the idea that you are in some way anti-Israel or even
no
anti-Semitic.
Way. No way. I understand what the Joint Chiefs told Harry Truman in 1948. When you do this, Mr. President, we object because 400 million Arabs will not like it. And they have the oil. Still true. Still very true.
So in this case, I mean, one of the I guess, elements of pushback that I've seen in terms of you saying that you think there's this buildup for a war in Iran is that Donald Trump was openly critical of Hillary Clinton's support, for example, for the war in Iraq. He called that a mistake. He called it a disaster. How do you respond to that?
I have no idea how to respond because I really took some hope from his comments during the campaign and somewhat after inauguration with regard to war. I thought he despised state building with the U.S. military as the main instrument. I thought he despised wars that had no end. He despised the treasury and the blood that went into those wars for no purpose other than just, I want to do war. I thought he was going to be, in that sense, a godsend for the United States. Well, he's not proven to be that way. He's proven the very first time he sent those cruise missiles into Syria on what were specious intelligence grounds. We still to this day do not know who used those chemical weapons, just like today we do not know. I don't care what President Macron says from France. Many of my European colleagues are calling him a lapdog of the United States right now, much the way they did Tony Blair in 2003. So I trust the intelligence community's views when they tell me things aren't right. That is to say, they can't make a conclusion. If they tell me they can't make a conclusion, then I think they're probably telling – and they feel burned from 2003, too, because there were lots of good professionals that I know about now that Tenet hid from Powell and from me, and I think probably hid from the vice president and the president, too, who objected to what was happening.
So are you seeing the same kind of thing where you don't have this kind of ideological commitment? George Bush didn't seem to have a neocon ideological commitment in those at all and may have been manipulated by others. That's certainly
I don't think Dick Cheney did either. I don't think Dick Cheney has a neoconservative bone in his body. What Dick Cheney is what I call a hyper-nationalist. And he expressed it best this way. If there's a 1% chance, I'm willing to do anything. I'm willing to kill anybody, bomb any country if there's a 1% chance that America might be hurt.
But are you seeing the same thing in Donald Trump in that he didn't feel
I don't know what I see in Donald Trump.
So you don't know.
I'm perplexed. I don't know who he is. I don't know what he is. I don't know if he even thinks beyond the TV screen, beyond Stormy Daniels, the Russia scandals, and so forth. He's so beleaguered and so imperiled right now that I'm not sure what he'll do because he wants to get this off the TV screens and out of his life. So I don't know what he'll do. I don't know how he'll change his views.
You say that one of the most crucial questions here as to whether or not the country is headed for the struggle with Iran is based on what you've described as the legitimacy of great power.
Yes.
What do you mean?
I mean that there is a struggle in the world right now. And Jim Mattis in the National Military Strategy just recognized this somewhat ambiguously, but he recognized it. There's a struggle right now between the rising power and the falling power. We're the falling power and China's the rising power. China already exceeds us economically in terms of purchasing power parity, and in a few years will exceed us in terms of gross GDP. So this is a real struggle. It's an existential struggle in some respects, just as climate change is, because these two powers, if we go to war with one another, as a Cuban diplomat said to me recently, a dying elephant can thrash a lot of grass. And in many respects, we are descending from the apogee of empire, and China is ascending to it. Graham Allison's written a book called The Thucydides Trap that says that is inevitable. War is going to happen sooner or later. We need to be playing it very carefully in these days of U.S. power decreasing and Chinese power increasing. So being deflected into the periphery of empire, into places like Syria, into places like Iran. I had an Israeli Defense Force member tell me recently that he thought Iran was an existential threat. I said, how can you say that? You're a military professional. Iran fought Iraq for 8 years of the most brutal war in 500 years. It couldn't beat them. We beat Iraq in 19 days. Give me a break. You think the IDF couldn't beat Iran in a heartbeat anytime it wanted to, if it could project the power there? This is crazy. How are they an existential threat? He had no answer.
Let me ask you this finally. What are you seeing in your students that gives you pessimism or optimism about the future?
Optimism.
Optimism.
It is the only thing that gives me optimism. What I see is dynamism, energy, talent, skill, a commitment to things that are beyond them, a willingness to do public service in the Peace Corps, in Teach for America, in whatever else might come up, being a foreign service officer, whatever. They do not want to have anything to do with the government in Washington in terms of war, though. And I think the Army and Marine Corps right now in particular find their poll showing that the propensity of this generation to be recruited has fallen off a cliff, and they're very worried about it. We are paying huge bribes right now to get men and women to serve in the armed forces. Huge bribes. In the Army, $40,000. Imagine how an Alabama 18-year-old just come out of high school looks at that $40,000. Pilots, we're 2,000 pilots short in the Air Force. We're paying huge bonuses for pilots to re-up. $455,000 to take a 9-year hitch. We are hurting right now, and no one's talking about this. The leadership has its head in the sand in terms of the all-volunteer force. We are putting them in war after war after war. That's one reason my students don't want to serve. They distrust the government in Washington. They don't want to die for Donald Trump. They're perfectly willing to die for America, but they're not willing to die for Donald Trump. This is a really dangerous situation for this republic.
Well, Colonel Wilkerson, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. The program is directed today by Kate Hatley, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.